Hi, Winifred. How are you doing? I just gave a brilliant little video on this question, but I forgot to record it. And so now I'm going at it a second time. I promise that other one was absolutely brilliant. I can't say much about this one. We'll have to see what happens. We're on chapter 3. No, we're not on chapter 3. See, I screwed up already. We're on chapter 13. And that must mean it's around November. And I hope you're enjoying the class. I hope that things are starting to come together for you. Chapter 11, 12, 13, 14, all we're doing here is just tweaking the model a little bit. And in chapter 13, what we're doing is we're allowing the seller to have some market power. That is, they face a downward sloping demand curve. And because they face a downward sloping demand curve, they can simultaneously choose the price and the quantity. They don't independently choose them. They're constrained by the demand curve. But they now have a choice in choosing Q and P. They don't just have to take the price as exogenous. Now, you saw in the chapter and the lectures that when firms can face a downward sloping demand curve, that means that their marginal revenue curve is twice as steep when they're constrained to only charge one price. And that leads to too little output being produced. And as a result, firms want to exploit this opportunity, and they're not constrained to just charge one price. And so price searching often leads to what we call compound pricing, complicated pricing. Situations like price discrimination, or tie-in sales, or multi-part pricing, two-part pricing, all these sorts of things. Your book has a little section in there on all or nothing pricing. When you're negotiating with somebody and you're telling them, hey, take it or leave it. Here's the price, take it or leave it. When you're doing that sort of pricing, you're saying, here's a price that is extracting some of your consumer surplus, maybe all of it, and I'm giving you the choice. Either take that price or don't, or just walk away. And the reason why you're able to get away with something like that is because you're a monopolist seller. I tried to get across in the chapter that when we think about monopolists, we often think about people like, you know, John D. Rockefeller, or, you know, somebody like that, Joe Monopoly. But often in our own lives, we're little monopolists ourselves, right? We're the only person selling our particular personal services. Now, most of the time, nobody cares. But when it comes to your friends and your family, they actually do care that it's you that's their friend, or you that's the son, daughter, husband, wife, or whatever. So here's a little question about a couple, a real couple. Everybody in this book, all the names of this book are people that I know. I often wonder what they would think if they knew I was using their names this way. But here's Heidi and Pat, and they're playing this little exploit affection game. How do you exploit affection? Well, you say, hey, you're generating consumer surplus over me. We're going to watch Netflix tonight, and we're going to watch the show that I want to watch. And if you don't like that, hit the road, right? You can play those exploitation of affection games if you're the monopoly seller and the other person has bad substitutes and is generating consumer surplus over you. So here's Heidi and Pat. They're exploiting this affection, but the marriage is it's on the rocks. It's a marginal marriage. The gains from staying married are just equal to the gains of divorcing. So what type of behavior on the part of Pat or Heidi would increase the chances of the couple divorcing? Well, anytime you try to exploit the affections of the other, which you've probably learned, that usually leads to confrontations. And if the relationship is just marginal, then very much likely is going to terminate. If you go on a first date with somebody, you're no monopolist seller at all. As far as the other person's concerned, you're just either male or female, just like millions of other people. And so there's no consumer surplus. There's no affection to exploit. And most people know this on a first date. You don't go on a first date and say, hey, we're going to go to my restaurant. We're going to eat the food I want to eat. And then afterwards, we're going to do what I want to do. And if you don't like it, take a hike. If somebody treated you like that on a first date, you would say, yeah, adios, see you later, right? There's no reason for you to hang around. So exploiting affection might increase your consumer surplus in the union, But it's a dangerous strategy, especially if the union is marginal. Over the past 50 years, the options of women in the labor market have improved considerably. How might this influence Pat's ability to exploit the affections of Heidi? Well, anytime the other party in a relationship gains substitutes for you, that means that the demand for your services, your affection, becomes more elastic. As it becomes more elastic, there's less consumer surplus being generated and less ability for you to exploit other people's affections. So if women have increased their alternatives to marriage through occupations outside of marriage, then that reduces male or husband's ability to exploit the affections of their wife. And so Pat's going to be in a less opportunistic position. C, suppose that a single woman named Debbie moves next door and that she gets along very well with Pat. How would this influence Heidi's ability to exploit Pat's affection? Well, just the opposite. Now Pat's got an alternative to Heidi. And so Heidi is going to be less able. She pushes Pat too far. Pat's going to start thinking about maybe he should switch partners with Debbie. What if the neighbor was Jerry and he showed an interest in Heidi? Well, just the opposite. This is the equivalent of having labor market alternatives. So anytime, if I have alternatives to my marriage, whether it's woodworking, golf, or another woman, that reduces my wife's ability to exploit my affection. Likewise, if she has more alternatives, that reduces my ability to exploit her affections. Now here's a little bit of advice. You never want to be in a relationship where the other person has lots of alternatives to you, but you have no alternatives to the other. That's a recipe for disaster. And in fact, in a lot of controlling, abusive relationships, often the abuser, one of the first things that person does is isolate the other person, cuts off their friends, cuts off them from their family, cuts them off from everything. By reducing their options when they start to exploit that person in a really negative way, the person has no choice but to stay. Does your answer in part C explain why we have sayings along the line, two is company or three is a crowd? If you're a couple and someone else shows up, that person is potentially a mate for one or the other person, but not the other one. And so that's going to cause problems. Even if the union stays together, increasing the options of one party and not the other just makes this union less stable and certainly puts one party in jeopardy. And so couples tend to go out with couples and not an odd person out. So we have expressions like two's company, three's a crowd, or fifth wheel, or something like that. All right. Well, there's kind of an intuitive question using Monopoly and not having too much math involved. Have a nice day.